economic development organizations. Onaben also welcomes community members to come check out the Native Marketplace, a highlight of the event, which features over 20 Native vendors. It is open to the public from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m., May 29th at Lewis and Clark College at Smith Hall. More information about this KBOOT-sponsored event may be found on kboo.fm, on the right-hand side of the homepage, under Community Events.
Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. It's just after 11 o'clock, and the food show is coming right up with a full host of guests and discussions. And stay tuned, KBOO Portland.
For the world to recognize it, everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away? Cause it ain't the right size or perfect, cause you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it ain't right to make people grow coffee when their families could be growing food. Working those lands for corporations don't do hungry people no good, cause people need food in their belly. They need some grow a bunch of cheap hamburger meat. You know those trees, they hold the topsoil, and those burgers aren't fit to eat. And you know it ain't right to punish the farmers for growing food clean and poison free. There ought to be a government who protect them, put tax dollars where they need to be, cause people need food in their belly. They need some drink for the guy.
You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Chris Siegel.
I'm Rachel Bennett.
And I'm Peter Schiff.
Today, we focus on the production side of food. The show is in three parts as we talk about farming in Portland, the labor it takes to keep small farms running, and the welfare of farm animals. To begin with, we have an interview with Margaret Gray, who's an associate professor at Adelphi University in New York and recently published the book Labor and the Locavore, The Making of a Comprehensive Food Ethic. She spent the past 10 years researching and interviewing farmers and farm workers in the Hudson Valley in preparation for writing the book. In Labor and the Locavore, she argues that we cannot have a complete understanding of our food system when we exclude the labor component from conversations about local food. To move towards a more comprehensive food ethic, food writers, advocates, and enjoyers need to include the subject of labor alongside sustainable farm practices, treatment of animals, and the difficulties of farmers. I talked with Margaret by phone here at the KBOO studios. So this is the food show, and I'm wondering, why is the subject of labor important for the conversation about local food?
So I think one of the things about the local food movement is that it's very romanticized. And we get the sense that the food tastes better, the food is fresher, the land is treated better, the animals are treated better. And I think in the whole conversation, the labor conditions are really just ignored. So when we talk about sustainability, when we talk about food ethics, I think we really need to include labor in that conversation.
And the process of writing Labor and the Locavore, it seems like it was quite a long one. It involved a lot of research, a lot of interviews. Could you talk a little bit about that process?
Sure. I did over a decade's worth of interviews. And initially, my interviews started with the farm workers, who I interviewed at two different time periods. And then I wanted to hear more from the farmers. Of course, there's a lot of literature and there's a lot in newspapers on farmers, so I didn't think I had to interview as many farmers as I did farm workers. But I, when I sat down to talk to farmers about the working conditions, I learned quite a bit that I hadn't really seen when I was just interviewing the workers.
So just give us a little bit of a background. You've mentioned the farm workers and farmers. Who are all the players when it comes to the issue of labor and agriculture?
Sure. Okay, so the average farm size in the Hudson Valley is 217 acres. So this is, a lot of it's very small-scale or medium-scale farming. And so many of them are providing food to the local food systems because the metropolitan market is huge. A lot of them are supplying to restaurants, to farmers markets, or selling through CSAs. And some of the farmers I met are brand new to farming. Some of them are second, third generation farmers. And it's also a mix of agricultural techniques. Some of them are farming organically. Some of them are using traditional methods. Now, when we talk about the workers themselves, today the workers are largely undocumented Latinos from Mexico and from Central America. There's also about 20% of the workers I met were here on guest worker visas. And so almost all of them were non-citizen workers. And what's interesting and what I dove into in part of the research was that this is a dramatic change from 3 decades ago. For most of the 20th century, the primary workforce was African-American and Caribbean workers. And starting in the early 1980s, you really saw this shift take place to the Latino workforce.
It seems that farm workers tend to be some of the most vulnerable members of society. So could you talk a little bit about that shift and what are the implications of the farm worker shift?
Yeah, so when we think about them being vulnerable members of society, I think this is always been true. I tried to dive into some archives to do historical research, and going back to the mid-19th century, you see Hudson Valley farms hiring immigrants, and you see discussions of communities worried about these outsiders and what are the outsiders going to do for the moral fabric of these small towns. And when we talk about vulnerability, of course, new immigrants are always a little vulnerable because they don't always know what their rights are, they don't know what to expect, and they compare their situations to home. I think also when you talk about vulnerability, you have to remember that an African-American workforce for a very long time in the 20th century was highly marginalized because they essentially didn't have citizenship status, especially if they were migrant workers. So in some ways, I see that the shift from the black workers to the Latino workers, it's this new vulnerability with legal status, because I think African Americans have seen great gains at the end of the 20th century. And so today, it's really about using the new immigrants who are not citizens, because we don't have a citizen group anymore that fits that same vulnerability.
And how has policy contributed to this situation?
So the policies today are that farm workers are excluded from overtime pay, they're excluded from a day of rest, and they don't have collective bargaining protections. And this isn't true only in New York State, but this is true in most of the United States. And it's a legacy of New Deal policies where farm workers were excluded. So on the one hand, you've got the law, and workers tell me, you know, the law treats us as if we're lesser workers, as if we're not the same level of workers. And then you have these, coupled with these vulnerabilities, where a non-citizen worker, both guest worker and undocumented, they're very concerned about maintaining a stable job and a stable income. And what that results in is that they don't complain. So this combination of the legal structure and the fear that the workers have make them very vulnerable. And I think it's one of the reasons why farmers don't hear complaints from them, because they're very nervous about telling farmers what they don't like about their job.
So I want to shift a little bit now to the farmer side of the labor equation. And I actually have ran a farm for the last 5 years. Now, we don't have any workers. We are the labor, but I can sort of feel for the plight of the farmer. So I'm wondering how much of this labor system have the farmers inherited, and how much do they contribute and perpetuate?
Oh, it's absolutely inherited. I think we can look at the wages of farm workers as probably one of the greatest subsidies you have to the agricultural system in the United States. I think even beyond that, I think when you have an oral tradition in farming, there's an expectation of what you can get from your workers. And I think if you consider the roots of agriculture in this country, and certainly you consider the role of slavery, I think there's an expectation on the part of farmers a century and a half ago about what labor meant to them. And I think it's been probably difficult for people to accept that they shouldn't be entitled to having a workforce to work at the lower wages. So I think that's a tough part. I think in terms of policy, even a farmer who thinks that this is a bad system and their workers should be eligible for overtime, I think it would be really tough for a farmer to advocate for increasing rights for farm workers. So certainly I met farmers who were very sympathetic to the conditions of workers, but they're not going to be fighting for improved labor laws. Some, you know, they would like immigration laws changed. They would like the guest worker policies to be simplified and the guest worker system to be easier. So, you know, it's certainly very complicated, and I write about all the constraints that farmers have on them. You know, when we think about Hudson Valley farmers compared to corporate industrial farms, these farmers, many of them are really struggling. And so you have this struggling class of farmers who are relying and dependent on this very vulnerable workforce.
And so you got to interact with these farmers over the course of several years. And I thought it was interesting you mentioned that there were some farmers you talked to who were speaking sort of apocalyptically about if the policy was changed and they had to pay overtime, you know, have inserted days off. But then after a while, the dialogue was more like, what would this mean for our business? So I'm wondering if you could sort of describe that sort of change, even in just the last, you know, 5-6 years.
Yes, I definitely saw this happen. So, you know, of course, anybody's reaction to any sort of change that you think you're going to have to spend more money tends to be apocalyptic. We can understand that. In New York State, there's been an advocacy campaign to try to get farm workers the same rights as other workers. And most of the time since the late 1990s, it's passed in the New York Assembly, but it's not even ever gotten out of the Labor Committee in the New York State Senate. And several years ago, it actually got out of the State Senate, and it went to the floor for a vote, and it was a margin of 3 votes. And I think that for so many farmers, that was a little bit of a wake-up call that, wow, the laws could really change. This could really happen. So I think, like any savvy business person, they're trying to imagine, well, how would I deal with this? How would I be able to pay overtime and not really, you know, really go out of business? And one of the other elements I document about farming in the Hudson Valley is that these farmers have had challenges again and again and again since the mid or early 19th century. So this is sort of part of agriculture in the Hudson Valley, is constantly trying to change their business practices due to outside challenges. And I think what farmers could do in this situation is, if they're already paying workers $10 an hour or $9.50 an hour, they can just adjust the base pay they're paying their workers to accommodate for the overtime pay. So some of them are in those positions. If you're already paying only minimum wage, then paying overtime is going to be a harder battle to pay. You also have some farmers who are giving workers free housing, and they can be charging a little bit for housing. So So, you know, I think farmers have really started to think about, well, how could I not have this cut into my profit too much and follow the law? And I've had other people say to me, well, if farmers just change the base pay to accommodate for the overtime, then nothing's really changed. But I don't think that's true, because I think I've met workers who are making that straight minimum wage and they're logging 80, 90 hours a week. So that could be a dramatic change for those workers. They could be making the same salary but not having to work the same amount of hours over time. And I think the benefits of that for workers could take a couple of years, but for workers who are already making just plain minimum wage, it could be a big difference.
You just mentioned housing as a kind of a perk for farm workers. And so I'm wondering, it seems like of all the issues, that was one of the more complicated. And so I would wonder if you could speak to that, speak to housing on farms.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, farmers will certainly tell you how challenging it is to house workers. So one of the in short, I think that the conditions of workers in the Hudson Valley essentially mirror the conditions of workers on the corporate industrial farms that you read about, those exposés. What I think is different and what I wasn't expecting to find was that there's this level of paternalism. And the paternalism is very much related to the housing. So the paternalism itself means that workers are getting some sort of benefits or protection, but the flip side of that is that the paternalism acts as a form of labor control. So when your housing is dependent on your job, there's more at stake, right? So this probably makes you what you might consider a better worker, somebody who's going to complain less, because you want to be able to maintain your housing as well as maintain your job. So that's where it does get very complicated, this paternalistic relationship that develops.
And speaking to that paternalism, as a reader of, you know, food writing, I thought it was really interesting the connection you made between the employer paternalism and sort of the hands-on care in producing food that's lauded by food writers.
Yes, I call it the price of proximity. So all the benefits from local about the intimate relationship, when Michael Pollan tells us we develop this trust relationship by looking a farmer in the eye, I think there is this parallel, because the paternalism develops due to the more intimate relationships that the employers have with their workers. So some of the larger farms in this country, you don't have farmers interacting with workers directly. You have middlemen, you have contractors and managers. But on the farms I visited, all the management was directly by the farmers. So yes, I think that that's exactly the same parallel, and it's one of the costs of local food, is looking at the relationship between the employers and the farm workers, that there's a power dynamic that takes place that leads to them, the employers, being able to control the farm workers more.
What kind of activity is there right now that is trying to right the wrongs of this flawed system?
Sure. Well, there's a bill in the New York State Legislature called the Farm Worker Fair Labor Practices Act, and the goal of the bill is to try to even the playing field so that farm workers have the same rights as other workers. And it was voted in the Senate Labor Committee, and it passed in the Senate Labor Committee. So now it's really a matter of whether or not the leadership in the Senate will let the bill go to the floor to be voted on. So that's one element that's happening. I think another element is that the farm worker activists and advocates in New York have, in recent years, started to reach out to food movement folks. So they're having meetings in New York City with some of the food-oriented nonprofits and trying to get them educated about farm worker conditions and involved in the campaign. So I think that's a significant shift from a few years ago.
Do you see what's happening in New York as a potential example for other places across the country?
I think it could be an example, because you have thriving local food systems throughout the country. And part of the reason the local food system is thriving is because consumers are demanding it. And we're demanding that animals be treated better, and we're demanding that we get organic food or at least fewer pesticides in our food. And what I argue in the book is when you think about those demands and when you think about our concern for the smaller farmer, our concern for keeping food dollars local, I think this all fits into what I call a food ethic. So I think if more consumers were aware of the labor conditions related to much of the local food they eat, then you could start to see the demand from the consumers as well. And let me just give you one example. When you talk to farmers, when you talk to people who run the green markets, they will tell you they get an extraordinary range of questions about farming practices and about the way the markets are run and the food is grown. And I have yet to meet a farmer who's told me that somebody has asked about the workers. So I think there's a lot of room for consumers to start asking the sort of questions that we asked about the environment and we asked about animals. And this is where I think the food movement can play a significant role, because it's really the food writing that has primed us to better understand the food system and to ask questions about it.
I think about that first episode of Portlandia where they're asking about Colin the chicken and his situation.
Yes, absolutely. And so someone I know who also works with food workers told me that, you know, if you had gone into a restaurant 15 years ago and said, can you tell me something about this chicken that I'm about to eat? They would look at you as if you had three heads. And today it's widely accepted that you can get information about this animal or even the vegetables. And I think right now we're at the place where if you ask about the labor conditions, you're going to be looked at like you have three heads. And I think the same sort of shift can take place as we raise people's awareness.
Margaret Gray, thank you so much for joining us on The Food Show.
It was a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
That was Margaret Gray talking about her book, Labor. That was Margaret Gray talking about her book, Labor and the Locavore. Now, I want to have a kind of continue this conversation a little bit. Before we do, we're going to take a look at a local farm here in Portland. And with that, Rachel's going to tell us a little bit more about Heart to Heart Farms.
So I went out to Heart Farms. It's in Sheridan. It was an amazing little spot. I drove out and drove up the road to the farm. There were little animals running all over the place and all kinds of unique projects in the works. And I visited with Tyler, who started the farm about 4 years ago with his wife. And they were inspired by the necessity of sustaining themselves and others with quality organic food. It is pretty cost prohibitive for a lot of people, so they have found ways to make this quality food available to themselves and others. And they're working on a campaign right now to keep their Free Food Fridays going. So if you're interested in that, you'll hear more about it, but you can go to their Facebook page, Heart to Heart Farms, and see how you can help with that. And for now, we'll go to the interview. Tyler, let's start out by talking about the inspiration behind Heart to Heart Farms.
Well, the inspiration, to be completely honest, started 4 years ago when my wife came home from work and she just had a 9-year-old girl in the ER that was pregnant. And it wasn't a business inspiration. The farm was started as a circle the wagons move to protect our family. I mean, we started farming specifically to get the chemicals out of our food. And what we realized very quickly was that eating organic was absolutely ridiculously expensive. I mean, it's cost prohibitive for most people. Our food bill went from $400 a month to over $1,200 a month almost immediately. And then we started raising our own food and realized very quickly that a lot of people were in the same boat we were, that realized the level of chemicals in the food that they were eating was more than they were willing to accept. And they wanted farm fresh, but they couldn't afford it. And so they'd come to me and say, well, can you raise this and can you do this and can you do that? And so we've grown really organically, just kind of out of the need of the community. So that wasn't a business inspiration per se, but more out of necessity to protect our kids and keep everybody healthy.
How did the farm come into fruition?
Well, that's an excellent question. Our first year really was just about self-sustaining. The property had been abandoned for 7 years. There was nothing on it, no barns, no fences. So we started, and everything was overgrown. It was 15 feet tall with blackberries and poison oak. And so I bought 2 machetes, 200 chickens, and 20 goats, and we just kind of went to town. And it was just inch by inch, we'd reclaim some of the land and try to put it to good use. And then as the community vocalized what they would want, you know, the community would come out and say, well, you know, I'd like some lamb, and I'd like some beef, and I'd like some pork. And so we just tried to expand so we could meet that need. And the farm itself has many different facets. We have the free food campaign, which is really one of the things that we're pushing for right now. And that was because we realized that there are many people that simply can't afford to eat organic. And we do try, and we try to undercut the market by about 30% and provide the top quality. I mean, if you go buy local grass-fed, grass-finished organic, you know, steak at the store, it's, you know, New Seasons Whole Foods, $20 a pound, you know, and that's absolutely outrageous. We try to do it, we keep it, you know, probably around $7 a pound. And we do a lot of work trading. So one of the things that's very unique that we pride ourselves on is we try to make sure that what we do is available to everybody. So we don't charge. Well, so we establish our rates, but if people don't have the money, we make it available, meaning that they can come and work trade. We do most of our transactions, 50% of our transactions, without cash. But then again, there are those people that can't afford even, you know, they don't have any time and they don't have any money. And so we started the Free Veggie Friday campaign. And that's where it originally started as a way to get the chemicals out of the livestock feed. And so we'd pick up about 10,000 pounds of produce on a weekly basis. And that was how we fed our goats and our chickens and our cows and our pigs, because it was food quality vegetables. And it was wonderful because the feed industry is, it's pretty disgusting when you really look at it.
Right.
And so, but inevitably we would get this produce that would be wonderful quality. And actually one of the weeks we received a pallet of bananas. It was about 1,800 pounds of bananas. And I just felt so guilty feeding those to my animals. So I put a post on Facebook that said, hey, is there anybody in need? We've got a bunch of stuff that looks great this week. Anybody that's kind of tight financially that could use some help? And the floodgates opened up, and it was insane. Mm-hmm. And we had people coming out of the woodwork saying, you know, look, we can't afford to eat fresh. We've been eating top ramen and macaroni and cheese because that's all we can afford. And the wife and I looked at each other and we said, we can't stop doing this. And so it started as just kind of a once, what we thought was going to be an isolated incident turned into a gigantic need, and we just couldn't stop doing it. Mm-hmm. So we've expanded what we pick up every single week. And so now we're at about 10,000 pounds a week. We bring it back. And out of that 10,000 pounds, probably half of it, maybe 60% of it, isn't even edible. I mean, it's spoiled. It's garbage. But a lot of it is really wonderful. You know, the apple might have a bruise, or the lettuce might be wilted, or in the bunch of bananas, there might be a couple that are squished or gone bad. But for people that the choice is, do I eat fresh or do I eat something out of a box? It's a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. And it's free. Mm-hmm. And there are no politics. There's no paperwork.
What kind of experience did you have with farming and raising livestock before you started Heart to Heart Farms?
So we started Cold Turkey. I grew up farming, but I stopped farming. My parents got divorced and I moved off the farm when I was 13 years old. Mm-hmm. So I had it in my blood. We joke around that, you know, it never really leaves you. I was familiar, you know, I watched my parents do it, but at 13, you don't really know how to do anything. So I spent many years overseas and then came back, and the family farm had, the family had lost the farm. My grandmother had passed away. Mm-hmm. And there was mismanagement, and they didn't understand inheritance taxes and estate planning. And so they lost the farm. I was coming home expecting to raise my kids. on the farm, and it was gone. And the whole family lived there. We had six different houses, aunts, uncles, cousins, grandparents. Everybody lived there together, and we farmed together. So it was super disappointing. And so I spent, you know, 12 years in finance learning the rules to the money game, insurance, mortgages, investments. Mm-hmm. And then the wife got out of the Army and came home one day after working in the emergency room and had that 9-year-old girl that was that had been pregnant. And, you know, when a 9-year-old gets pregnant, we could talk for hours about all the things that are wrong with that. Mm-hmm. But physiologically, that shouldn't even be possible. And so we started doing our research on the food industry, and within 6 months, we said, we're done. And we sold everything and bought the farm. And so when we started cold turkey. And I had many, many people say, you know, you need to do your research before you get started. But farming, and most things in life, you don't learn in a book. And so we started with goats and chickens because they were easier than most. And I learned that wasn't necessarily true with goats. They can get out of just about anything. So we messed it up for a long time, and then learned that the cows, you know, the cows that we raise are rescues from the dairy industry, because most of the industry incinerates Jersey cows at birth. When we learned that Jersey cows are incinerated at birth, it was just another one of those things that shocks you. You know, you think, how on earth, why do we have that system? Why does it work that way? And, you know, we've bred the Jersey cow because its milk is so rich in mm-hmm. cream. But in doing that, we've created an animal that doesn't grow fast enough for the commercial beef industry, and so nobody wants it. Mm-hmm. But we teach people backyard farming. And so we pick the calves up, and we get them on the bottle, and we've got, you know, the loss rate, the acceptable loss rate in the calf industry is scary, depending on what you read, between 20 and 35%. Which is sad, and that's because cows, unlike many animals, get 100% of their immunity and disease resistance from the milk, mother's milk. So when you pull them off mom at 1 day old, it makes them super vulnerable to disease. And so our loss ratio, we've been focused on it. We've focused a huge amount of energy on keeping our baby cows healthy, and so our loss ratio is down just below 8.5%, which is much better than 35%. But still means 1 out of 10 doesn't make it. And so what we do is we normally will, I can identify that cow, with the one that's not going to make it in the first 24, 48 hours. Mm-hmm. And we'll usually harvest him and donate him to a family in need, or sell him off, or even, you know, we harvest him and feed him to the dogs. But our philosophy, I believe the biggest respect you can give an animal mm-hmm. is to make sure that its life wasn't wasted, mm-hmm. that it wasn't in vain. And everything here, I mean, I love every animal here. Everything, everyone has a name. I can tell you the history on every single one, how they were raised, what their first week was like. I'm up until they're 1,000 pounds. I love every one of the animals. And people ask me all the time, how can you eat something you know? Mm-hmm. And my question is always, how can you eat something you don't know? Mm-hmm. Now, I know these animals had an incredible life. I know because I raised them by hand. I know that I know that when it is time for them to serve their purpose, that I walk them up by hand, give them their last meal. It's very prayerful, very peaceful, and then it's over before they know it. Mm-hmm. I know that they don't go to a slaughterhouse. Mm-hmm. And by doing this ourselves, well, it's not easy. I mean, emotionally, people ask me, do you get used to it? And I think if you're the right sort of person, you don't.
Right.
I mean, I don't ever enjoy it. It's always miserable. But I'm not a vegetarian. Mm-hmm. And I think the most responsible choice, if you're not going to be a vegetarian, is to either take ownership and do it yourself, or at least buy from somebody that does it themselves.
So you actually slaughter the animals here on the farm?
We do. We do. Now that, we aren't a USDA slaughterhouse. Mm-hmm. So the people that buy shares from us either have to be a part of that, or they have to be aware that mm-hmm. we do all of the harvesting here.
I had thought that you couldn't slaughter animals outside of the USDA certified slaughterhouses.
You believe it or not, so what is true is that if you slaughter an animal, if you, and we use the term harvest generally because I think the term slaughter applies more to the commercial industry. But if you harvest an animal outside of a USDA facility, you aren't allowed to sell the meat. So we aren't allowed to have somebody go back in our freezer and buy 20 pounds of beef. But what we can do in advance while the animal is alive is sell the animal by shares. So people will buy a quarter of that cow and we can all participate in the process together because you're allowed to harvest your own for personal consumption. Mm-hmm. You're allowed to harvest pretty much however you want. See?
Right.
And most of the time, I mean, I have people all the time that are very, very, very adamantly opposed to taking part. But when they watch it, it's nothing like what they thought. Mm-hmm. There is no suffering. It's immediate. It's very loving. It's always prayerful. Mm-hmm. And it's I get more heat for that than everything else that we do combined. I get hate mail every single week. Mm-hmm. I get phone calls that are threatening phone calls. Wow. Because people, especially the vegan community, is, you know, they're very vocal. And I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. Our goal is to open people's eyes to the reality of the industry. Mm-hmm. And that means taking part in it. If you're going to consume meat, at least consume it consciously.
Mm-hmm. So if somebody is interested in harvesting an animal, can they actually come and do it themselves?
Absolutely. We taught over 300 people to harvest their own livestock here last year. Mm-hmm. So, and that's everything from chickens to turkeys to rabbit to goats and cows and sheep. To pigs.
So let's talk about some of the projects that you have going on here.
Wow, I don't think you have enough time to talk about our projects. We have we've got some very exciting things going on. We just put in an aquaponic system, actually four different aquaponic systems. We've got two warm water systems and two cold water systems. So we're raising tilapia. So we should raise about 10,000 tilapia next year. We'll be raising catfish and bass, as well as crappie and bluegill, and we've got trout coming this summer. So we've, because water is about 10 times as efficient as land, you can raise about 10 times the amount of food on an acre of water as you can on an acre of land. So we've got aquaponic systems that are going in. We're starting a lot of hugel culture, which are, it's a system, a super efficient permaculture system where you essentially dig a hole, fill it with sticks and hot manure, and it creates a garden bed that is super nutritious and self-fertilizing for 5 to 10 years.
So as opposed to top dressing with fertilizers, you're actually putting manure in the ground where the garden's going to grow.
Absolutely. And using the hot manure to break down the wood, and so you have a slow time release of nutrients. So it's year after year after year, it replenishes itself. It's a really wonderful system, as well as catching the runoff from down the hill so that you don't have the erosion issues. Mm-hmm. We also just put in and are in the process of finishing up what's called a wallapini, and it's a sunken greenhouse. So you basically bury a greenhouse underground. And what happens, because the biggest challenge with greenhouses is during the summer, they're way too hot. You've got to roll up the sides and provide ventilation. But because it's sunken in the ground, you've got the geothermal effect of the clay. Mm-hmm. So as the greenhouse heats, it transfers the heat into the clay and the walls. Mm-hmm. And that clay retains it, brings the temperature during the day down and keeps it moderate. And then in the evening, when the temperature cools down, the clay releases the heat back into the air, and it creates a wonderful, even temperate environment. So it extends your growing season by up to 4 months.
Great. Well, it's been really fun and interesting to come out here. Thank you so much.
Thank you
for doing what you do and sharing your own.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for your time.
That was me speaking with Tyler at Heart to Heart Farms. I realized I accidentally said that they were in Sheridan, but they're actually in Sherwood, so right outside of Portland. And again, they are working on a campaign, an Indiegogo campaign for Heart to Heart Farms, so they continue Free Food Fridays. They receive 10,000 pounds every Friday, so it requires some equipment. They need a new truck. They've had some trailer issues, so to continue providing all this food for people and the animals, You can help them out if you want to go to their Facebook page at Heart to Heart Farms, or we'll put a link up on the food show website on KBOO Community Radio's website. And you can also go to the website for more of the interview to hear more about other projects that are going on at the farm, opportunities and stories. And yeah.
Chris. Great. Well, we're going to keep it rolling here. It's interesting, the flow of this show. We've kind of gone from labor on small farms to talking to small farms. And then he talked a little while about raising animals and the way that they raise animals on their farm. I guess what we'll do is, at the end, we'll sort of synthesize it all. He did talk about the sort of on-site slaughter and giving people the opportunity to sort of experience what it is, the industry of meat. That's a perfect transition into our next interview that Peter did, and Peter's going to tell us about it right now.
Yeah, actually, I thought that it was a pretty interesting topic change. Originally, this piece was going to be on at the beginning of the hour, but you know, public radio. Well, anyway, I wrote this intro before we had this discussion, but I do want to get back to this at the end of the show. Animal cruelty is generally accepted as a widespread practice in the factory meat industry. Harrowing tales have presented themselves to the public from early on, such as Upton Sinclair's The Jungle and Michael Pollan's Omnivore's Dilemma. Animals are packed closer and closer together and killed earlier for the sake of bringing the most healthy meat to market per time. For the consumer, this provides us cheap and available meat to eat more regularly than any society in our history. Farm Animal Rights Movement is a pro-vegan group which hopes to address the cruel conditions that animals face by removing them from the food chain. The movement seeks to educate consumers on the cruel practices and about the alternatives to meat consumption. I spoke with their director, Michael Weberman.
Michael, our Farm Animal Rights Movement, and we have been running nationally for over 30 years out of Washington, D.C., and we just opened our national campaigns office in Portland, Oregon, unofficially a couple months ago, and we had the hard launch last night, Thursday, May 15th.
All right. Well, what brought you to Portland, Oregon?
Our campaign staff for the last several years has been mostly remote, so we have people working in Portland, in the Bay Area, in Chicago. We had someone who was working out of Hawaii for a while recently, and as we've kind of built more of our campaigns team in Portland, what we noticed is that there's a lot of animal rights energy in this city, a lot of vegans, a lot of people that care about these issues a lot, and there aren't any large organizations in Portland. You know, there's community groups, which is great as well, but there's no one to really kind of tap into all that volunteer power in Portland. And so we realized that whereas in Washington, D.C., we've been kind of sharing the same volunteers with a dozen other groups, basically, it might make sense for us to have our campaigns run from a city that has people who are eager to volunteer with an organization rather than a city where everyone's already stretched so thin volunteering for so many organizations. Portland has a lot of energy around these issues, and people aren't able to do much about it because there's no groups channeling that energy anywhere, basically. So what we're trying to do is both help a community that already has a lot of passion for this issue do something with that passion, and we're also trying to, of course, help our own campaigns by getting a lot more volunteers a lot more easily than we could in a city that's stretched more thin.
What are you hoping to accomplish by harnessing volunteer power here in Portland?
This office isn't intending to necessarily make a bigger vegan impact in Portland in particular. It's actually helping our national work. And so what we do is we do events across the country that showcase to young people, college students, people at rock concerts, etc., the reality of animal agribusiness. And we ask them to take steps towards trying to reduce their animal consumption and maybe move towards a vegan diet. And so we have daily efforts we're doing on this, and we also have a few days of action where twice a year we mobilize thousands of people in the same day to put on a big event, and that's where it's really beneficial for us to kind of have a lot of volunteers to do phone banking for us and to send out the event materials to all of the people across the country and across the world even. It'll be very cool to have a lot of people excited about these issues, willing to make some phone calls and come in and have little work parties and whatnot, and you know, make these campaigns more effective and spread even larger than they already are.
Maybe you just talk a little bit about the issues that your organization hopes to address. Would you like to share any of the more harrowing details?
We raise and kill for food almost 10 billion animals every year in this country, just in the U.S. alone, every single year. That's 10 billion with a B. And, you know, these are animals, farmed animals, that are basically effectively no different than the animals who we keep in our homes and love, like dogs and cats. I mean, personality-wise, intelligence-wise, there's no real difference between the animals that we raise for food and the animals who we share our homes with. And yet, the animals that we raise for food, just by virtue of the sheer numbers, are really egregiously treated horribly. And there's a number of other consequences as well, you know, environmental. And these are issues that can't be avoided when you're raising this many animals for food. There's basically no way you could not factory farm 10 billion animals. There's not enough space to have not factory farmed 10 billion animals. There's not enough space to have even 1 billion animals not factory farmed. And so the reality is that for those of us who oppose factory farming, which is probably everyone, you know, I'm sure every single one of your listeners opposes factory farming, the reality is that we're going to all have to eat at least 90% less meat, basically, to ever have a world where animals are raised not factory farmed.
How much land area would it take to ethically raise animals?
Yeah, well, it's funny you said ethically raised, because of course that's kind of the part two to this, is that we don't really believe that animals can be ethically raised. You're taking animals, often a million animals, in one quote-unquote farm, you know, stacked up tall, confined into sheds. If you were to spread that out, it would take, I would imagine, 3 to 5 times as much land probably to raise this number of animals, you know, in a way that that many people would consider more ethical. And that's kind of, for me, when you ask the question, can animals be raised ethically, you know, that's, I guess if we got to, we'd already only be eating meat a couple times a week at that point, and I'd have to ask why keep eating it at all. Why is it worth killing animals for what essentially by that point would just be a form of pleasure? You know, meat wouldn't be providing us any serious sustenance at that point. If we really got to the point where we are raising fewer than a billion animals, it wouldn't be providing us any essential nutrients at that point. We wouldn't need it. So it would be solely an act of pleasure, and I have to ask, even if they're being treated okay, is it ever ethical to harm an animal for pleasure, basically? Is it ever ethical to kill an animal just for our dietary preferences?
You know, I hadn't thought of it that way. Yeah, you can synthesize all of your necessary proteins just from, like, breads, amino acids, and if pretty much rice and beans.
Yeah, legumes and a number of, yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, no, there's almost no reason why, other than just that it's a continuing cultural practice.
Yeah, it's enjoyable. So I'm not denying the pleasure we get from it. I just have to ask, if you were to ask someone on the street, do you think it's okay to harm an animal for pleasure? The vast majority of people would say no. A handful maybe of people would say it's okay, but the vast majority would say it's not okay to harm an animal for pleasure. But if the primary argument in favor of eating animals is convenience and pleasure, I have to say, what's the difference really, you know? So
the factory meat, sure, we're getting lots of it, as if it were to fulfill some dietary need, but what you're saying is it doesn't fulfill a dietary need.
Not really. Oh, there's no question the animals are raised somewhat better in those situations. I guess the question I have, though, which what's interesting to me, animals that are kept as companions, like dogs and cats, the better their life was, the more tragic we find their death. Like, think about that. If an animal lived for 15 years and was loved, when they die, we consider that a tragedy. Whereas a dog or cat that was abused, if they die, some people almost consider it like a mercy killing. Yet with food animals, it's the exact opposite. We say the ones that are treated poorly is egregious, and the tragedy is that, and then it's a tragedy. But the ones that are treated better, it's more ethical to kill them. And that's a really, really incompatible to me. I can't understand how we could say that with dogs and cats, the better their life was, the more tragic their death is. But with farmed animals, we say the exact opposite. The better their life was, the more beautiful their death is, the more, you know, kind of justified their death is.
I mean, different topic, but
sure.
What effect are you hoping that reducing the number of meat consumers by showing people the realities of factory farming, what effect do you hope that it will have on the meat business and the economy in general?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, yeah, I know some people have questioned, you know, if I stop eating animals or if I reduce my consumption, is that really going to make a difference? You know, are they really going to raise and kill fewer of them? And the reality is, the answer is yes. I don't have, actually, the graph is right here. I was going to say I don't have the graph in front of me, but I actually do have the graph in front of me. And so right here, we see that the number of animals raised and slaughtered in the U.S. in the last 8 years has gone down by almost a billion. Literally almost a billion fewer animals being raised and killed in this country. And if you were to look at a similar graph of demand for meat, number of pounds demanded, purchased, the graph is going down linearly with it. It's a causation relationship, not just a correlation relationship. So you see a linear relationship. The fewer pounds of meat people purchase at the grocery store, the fewer animals are raised and killed for food. And the fact, because their lives are already so short, because they're raised and bred to grow so quickly, and killed so quickly, the impact, it's a weird kind of twisted reality, but chickens are only kept alive for 45 days anyway, so eating less chicken literally 2 months later will save chicken.
So what you're saying is that the market will readjust. That was my concern, is that the grocers would keep buying the same amount of meat, so the meat producers wouldn't feel the difference.
They might for a couple months or something, yeah. But eventually, you know, they're in it for themselves. And it's not like you're not buying anything in replacement. It's not like people that stop eating meat stop buying food. Yeah, you know, they're buying just as much food. They're just buying different food. Grocery stores, it's just in their interest to stock the things that we want and to stop stocking the things we don't want anymore.
All right. Well, maybe you can talk about the benefits of a vegan lifestyle.
Yeah, sure. I mean, a vegan lifestyle will diet. We're talking mostly diet in this case. Obviously, a vegan lifestyle would also include, you know, not wearing shoes made from animal leather, which I don't. They're not animal. Speaking to the diet specifically, since that's where the vast majority of the animals are raised and killed, is for our food, not for these other purposes. Yeah, I mean, the American Dietetic Association has called a vegan diet, nutritionally adequate for people of all life stages. This is basically a direct quote, including infancy, pregnancy, lactation, elderly, for athletes. Adolescents, and they're saying that a vegan diet is the minimum as healthy and, if done well, can actually provide health benefits. And then it's not just for individual health, of course, it's for public health. You know, I don't know if you've heard about the antibiotics going on in factory farming, but over 80% of all antibiotics right now are going into factory farmed animals, not to people. So that means that even if you've never taken an antibiotic in your entire life, or if you've only taken it maybe once for a serious infection, people who eat meat are getting a constant stream, basically, of antibiotics in their body anyway, and it's putting us at risk for a superbug. You know, there could be a superbug infection that even someone who doesn't take antibiotics would still already have built up an immunity to, having never actually done it themselves. And then lastly, quickly, I'll just say is the environmental benefits. You know, the United Nations has recommended at least a 50% reduction in animal consumption because animal agriculture is the number one contributor to global warming and to a number of other environmental problems. So it's really, you know, a lot of benefits and no real drawback except for a few months of inconvenience. You know what I mean? Just a few months of readjusting to what you're going to eat. And, you know, once you get over that little hill, it's all benefits.
Yeah. And vegetables cook faster anyway.
If you like cooking especially and you don't mind buying some dry staples, you know, you can do it very cheaply as well, so, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Why is it unethical to kill farm animals?
It's for me, primarily lies in the unnecessary. You know, if we really had no choice but to get those nutrients by killing animals, then I guess, you know, it'd be a little trickier, you know, to say, yeah, is it okay to kill animals who are treated well if we need them? And that's a question, to be honest, I'm just glad I don't have to answer it because I know we don't need them, you know? And so since I know it is unnecessary to raise and kill animals, you have to say, what's the justification? And I just have to ask, you know, for the same reason, to me, it'd be unethical to kill a dog or a cat.
Okay, how can people get in contact with your organization, and what can they do?
So yeah, we just opened this Portland National Campaigns office, and for those of us, you know, anyone of your listeners who are, you know, vegan or near vegan or kind of on that path, you know, eating fewer animals, who want to get more involved. I mean, obviously, if someone's still eating a lot of animals, I think the first thing they can do is keep reducing the number of animals they're eating. But for those who are already pretty much there, who want to help spread that word, you know, we have this national campaigns office now, and they can email us info@farmusa.org. So info@farmusa.org. We got a lot of good ideas. We just need some more people to help us do them. So.
Okay. Well, thank you for your time, Michael.
Yeah. Thank you.
The Center for Disease Control recommends a daily intake of 56 grams of protein for adult men and 46 for adult women. There are 30 grams of protein in a chicken breast and 42 in a cup of black beans. I just wanted to get that statistic out before we started our discussion about meat really fast. So, first off, other than it being delicious, what do you guys like about meat and what don't you like about meat?
Well, I just wanted to say, I think it's interesting that the two interviews we just heard, they're both almost advocating for the same thing. One is, you know, the local farm is advocating for a more balanced diet with less meat consumption, sort of not focusing on the meat centric diet. And then the goal of farm, it does seem to be, is just to sort of reduce the amount of you know, farm animals. Now, you know, their goal is also, it seems like, to reduce it to zero, whereas the Heart to Heart is more trying to reduce it to a more balanced level. But it is interesting that through different methods, and one that, you know, he mentioned in the Heart to Heart interview that he was they would be contacted by activists, with folks, because they were trying to teach people what it is actually like to take a life, but that they're actually both working to go in that same direction of creating a more sustainable sort of animal system in our food system.
I guess I would say I believe in balance, and you know, I do feel there is overconsumption of meat in the society and a disconnect from the meat, or just from your food in general. And I feel like if we were more involved in the killing of the animals that we're eating, then there would maybe be a lessening of the amounts that were consumed. But I do believe that life feeds on life. We've evolved with eating meat, and I do feel like it's natural, but I do think it's something to be really aware of and conscious, and it should be ethically prosecuted.
Yeah, ethical beef is sort of a slogan that I've been telling other people in my community. And, well, I think we can get away from these practices that we don't like in the meat industry, like packing them together, injecting them with tons of antibiotics to compensate for the fact that they're way more dense and exposed to far more sources of infection and other animals. Like, these animals, we used to go out and hunt them. They used to be out in the wild. But now we have them packed up in a box just so that we can pack them in a smaller box after their departure from the planet. And right now here in America, we love eating meat. I think that came sort of from a culture in the New World. We thought we were in such a land of plenty. Why not just go ahead and eat as much as we could? But, I mean, I just read that statistic. So that was one chicken breast gave you almost enough protein for a whole day. So that means that pretty easily you could eat like 3 chickens a week, and that would even be too much. But, yeah, I mean, the first thing I think is that we all should cut down a little bit on our meat consumption to get it. I mean, right now we're probably eating way more than enough protein, or none at all for those of you who've taken a vegetarian lifestyle. But I think once we can decrease our demand for cheap meat, like people who need to eat a lot of meat, they're going to buy it at the lowest possible price so that they can get the most of it. I think once we can decrease our demand for that, we can start sort of buying meat that we know where it came from, know how it was treated, and can feel good about both buying it, eating it, and where it came from. And I hope that that's a place we can get to and sort of get food out of the control of the corporations and back into our homes.
So, unfortunately, that's it for this episode of The Food Show. Hopefully these conversations continue. Remember to talk about where your food comes from, specifically meat, and try to infuse the labor issue in the conversation. I do want to thank our guests, Margaret Gray, Michael Weberman, and Tyler at Heart to Heart Farms. Also, a huge, huge, huge thank you to our board operator, Tammy. Remember to tune in to KBOO every third Wednesday of the month at 11 a.m. to hear The Food Show. And if you missed any part of today's show or want to hear past episodes of the show, you can find The Food Show archived on the KBOO website. A special note, I'm going to be taking over Locus Focus. So I'll be talking with Dan Barber, chef and founder of Blue Hill at Stone Barn. Sorry, that was misleading. Taking over Locus Focus for one episode. So I'll be talking to Dan Barber about his new book, The Third Plate, on June 2nd at 10:15 a.m. So please tune in to listen to that. It's more of the conversation on local foods. Stay with us for Jazz Lives, coming up next on KBOO. Until next month, I'm Chris Siegel.
I'm Rachel Bennett.
And I'm Peter Schoaf.
Thank you for listening to The Food Show.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at their carbon-neutral eco-brew pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver. Available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com. Also by The Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. And stay tuned for jazz with Nick and Reggie's here, and that'll be just following the noon news headlines. Thanks for tuning in to Public Affairs this morning on KBOO, KBOO Portland.
Those trees, they hold the top song, and those burgers aren't fit to eat.
This is KBOO Headline News at noon for Wednesday, May 21st, 2014. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Patrick Wilson. In local news, if you're wondering what the unusual language is you're hearing on the street, it may well be Russian. It turns out that in Oregon, Russian is the third most frequently spoken language. We are the only state where the Russian language is this popular.
In October, it was learned that a major earthquake on the West Coast could cause devastating landslides, seriously damaging schools, according to the Bulletin of the Seismological Society of America. The report concludes that 28 public schools across the state, especially schools in and around Seattle, are at high risk of being swept away. In many cases, there are no practical ways to eliminate the threat. The only logical action may be to abandon the most threatened schools and replace them with new facilities.
The Appropriations Committee of the California State Senate will soon decide if a bill to place a moratorium on fracking goes to the floor for a vote or dies. Local activists are rallying to urge Senator Kevin DeLeon, the committee chair, to support the bill. These activists are supported by Credo, the Sierra Club California, and a Center for Biological Diversity. Credo, an American mobile virtual network, has already submitted 21,000 letters and has reportedly made 1,000 phone calls to the California State Senate in support